Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe, and everything.
Hello and welcome. We are back, The Vicar and the Witch, and again, we're on the subject of prosperity and money and generally all that stuff because it turns out it's absolutely fascinating.
It's a big thing, isn't it?
It's a big thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's come up for me since we last spoke is just some observations, really. So one of them is that clearly what we're going to end up talking about is trust a lot.
Yeah.
The second is that I really, really, really do believe that an essential part of this is the understanding that money is simply a mode of exchange and that it has no, I mean, ultimately it has no true value unless, well, even then, even if you were talking about actual gold, anything only has an agreed upon value between us. And,
yes.
You know, if I don't like gold and I don't want your gold, then your gold has no value to me. But that it's always seemed to me that it doesn't matter how much some people have, there will still always be enough because, I mean, in a cynical way, because they keep just printing more, but in a real way, simply because it's not the money that matters. What matters is abundance. And I think that's why people get so set on calling it prosperity rather than money. Is because, you know, I am clearly very prosperous. We don't necessarily have actual money, but we have got a house and a garden somewhere insanely lovely and each other, etc. And those, to me, those things matter far more than money in the bank. And there was a third thing. Maybe it's gone. Oh, maybe it was that I remember doing a journey about money when I realised I had a big load of stories around money, and that partly I viewed it as evil, partly I saw myself as being part of some kind of bizarre family curse. And I think there was a whole other thing. I don't remember what it was. Oh, yeah, I very much felt like I owed it to my kids to sort out my relationship with money. Because otherwise the bizarre family curse was going to, you know, arrive with them being each generation in my family has been less well off than the last by a very, very significant margin over the last 3 or 4 or something from an ancestor who was a millionaire. I'll tell you that story in a sec. But anyway, so I did the journey for money, and the main thing that money told me was that it doesn't like to be obsessively looked at in that mindset of like, oh, is there enough? Is there enough? Is there enough? And I must say, along with the day where I got sacked from the cafe and therefore, which I must also tell you that story because it sounds bad, but it wasn't. And suddenly there was this tidal wave of work is that also the minute I stopped obsessively looking at my bank balance, I moved out of debt and into the black. And that was massive for me. And again, that's all about trust.
Yes.
Trust that it will be there.
And that's exactly what St. Paul was trying to say. If it was St. Paul in 1 Timothy 6, which everybody quotes, which is money is the root of all evil. It doesn't say that. I've mentioned this before, but it worth saying again. It says avarice, which is obsession with money, whether you've got it or not, which is just what you were talking about, is a root of all the crap in your life. But before he says that, he says diatrome and skesasma. He says having sufficient, diatrophy and skesasma means a roof over your head, clothes, holidays, everything you need. So basically what it means is you've got a card that means you can go to the shops and get whatever you want. You can get whatever clothes you want. Your house is secure. You can go on holiday 4 times a year, was the Jewish thing. You can pay for people to look after your sheep while you go on holiday, after that, don't seek for money for its own sake. Because some who have done that have lost their souls in the process. That's what he's saying. That's exactly the same as Jesus saying, the quotation is, we're told it's a rich man, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven. Well, firstly, the legend is that the eye of the needle was the name of a gate into Jerusalem, which was very narrow, and you couldn't take a camel through it wearing panniers.
Ah-ha-ha. So a camel can go in there.
It basically means you don't take it with you.
Yeah.
Don't carry this weight. And the man who's the wealthy young man, it's very interesting. The word is plousios, which means heavy with possession.
Yeah, which and is the a different word thing entirely.
Possession means you are possessed.
Yeah.
Are you possessed by your possessions?
By your possessions.
Owned by your possessions. And when I used to do workshops, I used to say one of the greatest and most terrible possessions in the modern world is the school catchment area.
Yeah.
We've got to live in the area where we can send our child to school. And that's one of the reasons why we've gone so skew-if. Mm. You know, that people think they've got to live in an area where their child goes to school because they can't trust the schooling. So we have got big messes. But thank you for raising that. What came up for me is this thing again and again, and you did do it last time, and you did it very kindly and well, but everybody does it, which is think of the starving millions in India. And I went along with that. You can't help them when you've got an issue with prosperity.
Yeah.
End of. Do not come to me and say, I can't have money because people in the other end of the world are starving. Because that is resistance to the nth degree. Until we have a prosperity conscience, we can't teach those who don't.
Fair point.
Yeah. So it does come back to God, me, you. Until I'm not screwed up, any help I try to give you is going to be screwed up. And look at things like Live Aid and Band-Aid. They were marvellous, but did they solve the problem? Temporarily. Band-Aid. That's what they called it.
Mm. Well, they knew that's what it was.
Exactly, they knew that's what it was. But we have a society where we aren't teaching people to let go and let God. We've lost so much. Well, we've lost our connection to the earth, so we don't even trust the cycles of the earth. It is a huge, huge issue. And I'm actually going to go back and say, when I win my 5 million, mm-hmm. I'm still hiring the Caribbean island. I am still hiring the aircraft, but I will hire one aircraft.
Okay.
And I will do enough reforestation to more than triple the carbon footprint that I do in that. But I would like to offer unconditional holiday joy to as many of the people I know who would like that.
Mm.
So I'm going to be unrepentant about that one.
Okay. Well, I'm going to refuse to comment.
That's absolutely fine. And you can refuse to come, but I'm happy to thatch your
yes,
roof.
I will. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So something so clear came up in me and I've got distracted. When we talk about sitting here with our white privilege in our white privileged country, that is the entire... one of the pillars of
capitalism,
yep. Imperialism, the broken, contorted patriarchy and all the rest of it. And we talk about people in other places who don't have what we have. I think it's so hard to sit here and imagine that we know anything about their situation, frankly.
Yeah.
And that we can help. Because I'm not sure that anything we could do for the positive, like having lots of money and wading in there like bloody Band-Aid and thinking we can sort it out, could help. But I think that... the fundamental injustice, in my opinion, is around access to land.
Oh, yeah.
And that ownership of land, even though I can sit here and say, oh, yes, I own my own house, I'm so lucky. Ownership to land, in the end, fundamentally, is where we've gone somehow or other so wrong, because so many people do not have the access to the fundamental generosity of earth.
Yes.
If you haven't got somewhere to plant something, or you haven't got a forest you can go to harvest, or whatever, then you do need this bizarre stuff called money.
Yeah,
because,
you do.
Because you can't trust that life will take care of you, because you are born into a system which is rigged in such a way as makes it nearly impossible for life, by which I mean what you mean by God, probably. To take care of you. And so, in a way, I think the whole thing of prosperity consciousness is really, or money consciousness and all the rest of it, is so much murkier than I can make it okay for me. Because we are part of the whole of the warp and the weft of life. And on the one hand, we are only ever responsible for ourselves, and we can only be responsible for ourselves, unless we have small children, in which case, yes, absolutely, we're responsible for them. And that therefore, we just need to do our best in our own life. We need to be the very best version of ourselves that we plausibly can be always. So that part of the warp and the weft of life is as strong as it can be to try and send its messages of strength and generosity and all the rest of it out to the rest of the warp and the weft of life. But I do also feel that there must be, and I don't know what they are, other than always, 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 always understanding that with every single right we ever have comes a responsibility. Yeah. And yes, maybe we do all have a right to those things that you're saying are said in the Bible. Perhaps we've all got a right to a home over our head and a full belly. Well, of course we have. It's our absolutely birthright as a creature on this planet. Mm. But we've made it so complicated
for
ourselves.
We have made it complicated. Yeah. We have created our own karma with money.
Yeah.
And enclosure, for example, you know, in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, totally. But we have to remember that with the right to a roof over my head and full belly comes the responsibility of making sure that the other people around me, people in the loosest, most beyond human sense of the word, also have a roof over their head and food in their belly.
Well, I do try and do that. This is going to sound really arrogant, but the whole point is that I've studied this, and I have videos up on YouTube with basics. Mm-hmm. I've written 4 books on prosperity, and never, ever once when somebody's written to me saying, I need your help, have I not helped?
Great.
Have I not done what I can? And I will send out PDFs of all my prosperity books for free to somebody who hasn't got the cash to buy them. And that's why I wrote them. Mm. Because they're how I got out of my situation. Now, I'm not. I've got another one at the moment. I have karma around money, about being a white middle-class woman who manages to lose her money frequently and who's promised things that don't fulfil, so therefore has to rethink life. Mm. And my father, when I was young, said to me, because he was a steam engine enthusiast and he bought steam engines because he had the money and ran out of money very quickly buying steam engines. But both my parents were very along the lines of the boy gets the money, the girl gets the clothes and the jewellery and the furs in my mother's case. But my father did say to me, I've put a life insurance policy in place for you so that you will have something which will enable you to put a deposit on the house. You don't get it till you're 30, because I don't want you to fritter it away. Okay, he was being controlling, but it was also kind. But there is a policy in your name, so you never have to worry, Maggie. I want you to know that. Because you may not marry. You may not marry somebody like that. And when I was 32, he left my mother, cashed in the life insurance policy and bought a house for him and his mistress, and then left it to her when he died. Now, actually, it's okay. It was his money.
Yeah, the very, very same thing.
Yeah, it was his money. He had the right to do it. And my dad was so happy that last 18 months of his house. Yes, I would have liked the bloody chest back, because I like the chest he got in the house. And Leslie, I want that bloody chest now. Is that clear? But apart from that, no. So what? Move on. And the same is happening at the moment. My mum's going into a retirement home at the end of this week. And it's a very expensive one, because she wants to live in the manner to which my dad kept her. Mm. And if she lives another 3 years, there will be no inheritance because we're selling the house. And that's just how my life is. Okay. Can I be upset about it? Hell yes. Is it my money? No. Have I any right to it? No. Have I ever, ever died of starvation? No. Yeah. Am I capable of earning a living? Have I written books on prosperity? Can I go back and read them again? Can I make peace with the fact that I'm never going to own a house? Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, it doesn't mean to say there aren't moments when I go, for fuck's sake!
Yeah.
What is this life all about? I went to a school reunion, which was when I was very, very ill. Oh, and being ill as well. God, you know, that put us back into debt. Mm. But I was at this prosperity, this school reunion, and my school friends were old school friends from back then. And I hadn't been in touch with them for generations. I mean, literally generations. And they were just going, how did your life turn out like this? You were a nice white middle-class girl in Edgbaston in Birmingham. Why didn't you marry like we did? Why didn't you become a life coach when you were 40 when your husband could fund it?
Oh.
You know, and there was one time in my life when I was very jealous. It was the lady who started the Interfaith Seminary in the United Kingdom. She married somebody wealthy enough to send her to New York to do the training to set it up.
Mm.
You know, and there was a bit of me that went, but then I realised it was my shit.
Yeah.
And it's always my shit.
And presumably her job to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Exactly. And oddly enough, my job to come along years later and teach the whole seminary prosperity consciousness. Meow. Sorry. Oh, if you're hearing noises, I have a very needy beagle who's decided that life is not complete without being
serious
cuddled. So,
stroke-itch.
Yes. So, and I expect you'll have your baby in soon as well. So if there's, it's
sure, whinging. My baby will come soon.
Yeah. But we have this such a strange attitude in the West. We think we're rich and we're not. We're spending all our money on stuff that is so utterly unnecessary. I remember, I'm incredibly privileged. My dad paid for me to go to China with him. That's a huge privilege. But I worked in China, travelling in all the places with people who had absolutely nothing. And I also went to Russia and stayed with people who had absolutely nothing. And one day when I was in Russia, my then husband and I, we were being fed to the nth degree. We were there to work at the teaching hospital in St. Petersburg to teach them holistic health and healing. They knew more than we did because they had no money. They were doing it anyway. We were just privileged gits coming in from the other side of the planet trying to teach them something they had to do anyway because they didn't have anything. This was back in Gorbachev's day. And we decided to take the people we were staying with out for dinner. So we took them to the Literary Cafe in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, which is supposed to be the best place. There was hardly any food available on the streets back then. This was 92. And halfway through the meal, the mother of the house just wept. She said, I can't understand why you're wasting your money on this rubbish when I could feed you so much better for so much less.
Yeah.
And she was right. We were trying to treat her, but we were actually making her life more miserable by showing her that the world out there really wasn't worth anything.
You sure? Yeah. Yes, sorry. Again, derailed by his side thoughts. So,
I'm sorry, I have so many stories. That's the trouble, isn't it?
No, but it's, you know, your stories are part of who you are, and your stories are always such kind of learning and teaching experiences. And that was it. I remember hearing this absolutely wonderful story, which for me kind of encapsulated the, in a way, the Puritan work ethic of so much of our culture. Which was, apologies, that's now my dog.
Oh, that was
my
loud.
Attention. I know, I'm sorry. I think he heard beagles on the other end. Is this lovely story, and it's probably apocryphal, who knows, but anyway, of, you know, your average Western kind of American guy, and he's gone off and he's gone for his holiday in Mexico, and he's having the most wonderful, relaxing time fishing. And he meets up with three locals and they all spend the days fishing. And then at the end of his 2 weeks or whatever it is, he's like, okay, I've got to go back to work. And he's clearly miserable about it. And they want to know, you know, why you're having such a lovely time here fishing. What, you know, why, why on earth would you go back to work? And he's like, oh, well, you know, it's all about saving for my retirement. And then what are you going to do when you retire? Well, I'm going to come back here and go fishing.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And, yeah.
I've got a parallel story of that, which is the... It's almost exactly the same. Somebody looks at a man fishing and says, why aren't you at work? You could be earning wonderful money doing this, and then you could do what you love. He said, I'm doing what I love now.
Yeah, great.
We are certainly in such a tangle about it, and we think so much is utterly necessary when it isn't. I mean, taking everybody to a Caribbean island isn't necessary. I will own up to that, absolutely. And it probably won't ever happen, but... It gives me joy to think about it, you know, to be able to say, if I manage to manifest more money, I can share it.
Mm. Yeah.
And I can make us more rock solid so we can do more sharing.
Yeah.
You know, Mum's moving into this place and she's sort of worrying about how expensive it is. And I'm just sort of saying, but Mum, that means you've got a whole pension every month to spend what you want. You don't have to pay the electricity bill, that's taken care of. You don't have to buy food, that's taken care of. You're actually exceedingly prosperous. And when she's got that into her head, she's very happy. Because she thinks, oh, I can buy my friends lovely presents again. Because she was living on a pension, she's in her 90s. So all my dad's pensions have pretty much run out. So, But she had no mortgage and it's absolutely fascinating being with my family and hearing them whinge about money when they've got so much more than we have, and yet, hey, aren't any happier?
No, this was so luckily. I was really, really young when I had this experience. So, in my very early 20s, I briefly lived and worked in London. It didn't last long. I'm so not a city girl, but very, very briefly, I got up one morning and I had a bath or whatever it was, had a wash. And I noticed that on the end of my bath, looking particularly decorative and beautiful, there was a bottle of shampoo and a scrunchie. And there was, I'm sure there was a third thing, but I can't for the life of me any longer remember what it is. But let's pretend it's a pot of face cream.
Yeah.
And I just thought that it looked like this beautiful still life. There was something really pleasing about it. And what are they called? It was a Body Shop shampoo, and it was almost certainly some other sort of terribly ethical and not particularly expensive brand of face goo. And I'd made the scrunchie by myself. It was the 80s, they were cool. And
really?
Yes, honest. Such strange things. Anyway, so I went to my friend's house, and my friend was married to a merchant banker. She was incredibly wealthy. And I looked at the end of her bath, and lo and behold, in the exact same place, I mean, just, you know, I happened to see it because I happened to go to the loo, there was bottle of shampoo, scrunchie, face goo.
Yeah.
Only hers were Yves Saint Laurent, Chanel, and something else. Yeah. And I realised in that moment that the same three items on the end of her bath probably cost... I don't know, 10 times more or something, but that they were giving her no more joy than mine were giving me. And that I realised then this really big thing about humans is that unless we learn to be content, we will always want the bigger one, the better one, the newer one, the faster one, the one we've written on it or whatever.
Yeah.
And that is a choice, and that I could choose not to want more.
You can and choose.
I would
not
be
to.
Happier if I did.
Yes.
And so I did.
Yes. It is all about choice and trust.
It is. It really is. And choosing to be grateful.
Yeah.
But which is, you know, no bloody good if you're if you're living in a ditch and it's raining. But
no.
When you have got enough.
Sufficient.
Yeah.
But we are so ill-trained now, and we are ill-trained because we haven't got these attachments to fellow adults. So this is why we're ruled by the Eton Brigade, because these kids were sent off to school, so they were attached to their peers rather than attached to a home and a family. Some of them didn't even go home for holidays.
Wow.
We are so, and I've forgotten my point now because I've gone off on a side thing. You're having your leg shagged. Ladies and gentlemen, Susie is now having her leg shagged by her puppy Django.
You are horrid. He's got off and is now leaving the room.
That's me trying to find out what it was I was going to say. What was I talking about? Never mind. You, it'll come back, won't it?
Well, obviously, I have no coherent thoughts.
My girl dogs shag legs sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, not the current ones, but previously it's happened. Bella and Didcot. Yes, they both shag legs. They were probably gay.
Okay. Well, Sorry. Whatever.
No problem.
No. It's yes.
What was I saying?
I haven't got the slightest idea. I'm so sorry. No. I was having my leg.
I think there was going to be a good point in there somewhere, but I can't remember what it was. Oh, well.
Maybe it was about gratitude. Because that, to me, that fundamental in the enough story and the sufficient story is the gratitude story.
Yeah. Oh, I know exactly what it was. Thank you. Yes. The training we've got, and it's not their fault because they were trained. I took a photograph of the underside of a double snowdrop. Because my mother loves snowdrops, and she used to have a vase which had a mirror underneath, so you could look in the mirror and see the inside of the snowdrops.
Great idea!
It is a lovely idea. So I didn't pick the snowdrop, but I put it in my hand in between the third and fourth fingers, upside down, and took a photograph with my camera phone of this exquisite, utterly. Oh, it's so, so beautiful. And sent it to my mother in the letters I write to her every fortnight. Mm. And my mother said, "Your fingernails are dirty." But that actually sums up where we are. You know, my daughter's fingernails are dirty. My daughter should have nice manicured nails.
Rather than, sent me a lovely picture of a beautiful flower.
My daughter is in the garden where fingers get dirty and sent me a picture of a flower. And that actually does sum up where we've been trained to be, which is you've got to do it right, you've got to do it appropriately, which means you've got to have this amount of money and that amount, and you've got to have your house and you've got to have this and you've got to have that. Otherwise, you are wrong.
Wow, okay. Is that what it is? If you're poor, you're wrong?
Yes. You actually just do see that from the privileged people. Well, you know, we're all right. Why aren't you? But it actually goes into the psyche that if you believe you're wrong, you actually have been trained, you believe you have no worth, and it is about worth. You have to trust that you have worth.
That I read something the other day that there's some brand or other of something. I can't even remember what it is. I'm afraid advertising's a bit wasted on me. But there's adverts that have been going for years now that are all about because you're worth it.
Yes.
And that they tap into a core feeling of worthlessness.
Yes.
Specifically amongst white women.
Yeah.
But women in general, women in our culture in particular, and all of them, all of us, according to this piece of research, at our core feel like we're just generally a bit worthless and not all that we should be. Yes. And that, I mean, even that, presumably, the whole way in which all of our culture trains us to, well, okay, let's just really get right back down to it. The whole culture of original sin.
Mm.
We are originally and essentially not a good and beautiful being.
Yeah.
Means that therefore we don't have permission or the right or something to enjoy the abundance of what's being offered by the gods.
Yeah.
So talk to me about that.
Well, that's a complete fundamental misunderstanding of the teachings of a guy called Jesus of Nazareth.
Oh, okay.
Because love your neighbour as yourself. Consider the lilies of the field. You know, you are as important as anybody. You are vital. Jesus never went up to anybody and said, "Are you worthy of my healing?"
What about original sin then?
Yeah, but we talked about that before. That was invented by St. Augustine in the 3rd century. It's completely unknown to the Jewish faith.
Ah, okay. I'd forgotten that. If I remember it now.
And it was made much worse by St. Anselm at the end of the 13th century, the end of 1200s to 1300s, by this horrible idea of penal substitutionary atonement, that we're so bad that punishing us wasn't good enough for God, so he had to send his divine son to punish him to show us how bad we were, and now we could be all right.
Right.
And that's it's just so wicked. You know, this is come from a load of blokes, not married, not with children, not knowing what actually everyday life is about, probably paid by the church so that they don't have to worry about these kind of things. They were married, by the way. Priests were often married up to the 17th century.
Really?
Oh, yes. It wasn't actually made totally illegal till the 17th century. Quite a lot of them had... they were all told that they could stay married, but they mustn't have sex.
Ah, if you became a priest after you were married.
Yeah, that right. sort of thing. And it's just all this... Oh, it is actually horrible patriarchy, but that wasn't around in Jesus's day. But then again, we don't know.
Patriarchy wasn't around in Jesus's
no,
day.
No, that the actual... yes, the patriarchy started with the fall of the first temple. You're absolutely right. But if the teachings of Jesus, and if you look at them in the line of the first temple, you'll see the whole focus on Mary, his mother, passing the mantle on to him at the wedding of Cana, which is the divine feminine giving the son the power. Mm-hmm. And she stood by the cross, and it was Mary of Magdala who was there at the time of the resurrection. The Gospels are trying to teach us the importance of the balance between masculine and feminine and trust. They all are, judge not lest you be judged, all that kind of thing. But they just got picked up and run with and turned into a religion. And it's happened with every religion. Mm. And the Hindu religion has the caste system. Mm. You know, whenever God gets into the hands of the powerful, they lose God and go for the law.
Yeah.
So, yes, original sin has been a hideous thing. You are unworthy. And the prosperity churches in America are just as bad, which means that if you're not wealthy, it means you're not worshipping God properly. Joel, I can't remember what his surname begins with an O, the head of one of the great prosperity churches. And, of course, you have to tithe to them. Otherwise, you won't get wealthy. I always say to people, you tithe to, if you want to tithe, you tithe anonymously to whatever inspires you. Night before my ordination, the bishop and I went down to Tewkesbury Abbey because I've got the kind of bishop who stays the night, which is, but not in a sexy way, obviously.
Obviously, yes.
And we went down to Tewkesbury Abbey the day before so that we could just sit in silence, in peace. And I love this place. I love it. And they had a knight's chapel, which was where a knight would spend the vigil the night before his being made a knight, which they had to do. They had to spend a night in the church atoning for their sins and promising to live an honourable life, whether they did or not is another matter. And that had been locked off for about 5 years. And the day before my ordination, we turned up at Tewkesbury Abbey, and not only was the choir practising St Matthew's Passion,
wow,
but the door was unlocked. Amazing. And I was able to sit in that chapel for an hour in meditation, and I left a tithe on the altar. Because that's what a tithe is. It was, thank you, God. That was a great gift. I'm leaving some money on the altar. It is of no importance to me where you send it.
Yay. Right, okay.
That's a tithe.
That's a tithe. So just as much as the church might find it, so might a person coming in next who really needs it.
Or it might get part of a dust bunny underneath the altar, and it may be there for 30 years until the money is of no use. That's incredibly unimportant. But when people say the tithe comes to the church, that's corruption. Because apart from anything else, if it's on a standing order, you don't know if they're going to inspire you next month. It is all about being absolutely fresh. I tithe every month when we get money in every month because we're publishers, so we get the fees for the books that people have bought. Mm. And thank you for buying the books during the pandemic because you kept us safe. I'm very grateful. I tithe every month, but I tithe manually to whomsoever has inspired me that month. And usually, unfortunately, I can't do it anonymously anymore because you have to do it by the internet.
It's tricky, isn't it? You've got to do it by the internet.
Yeah, it's really difficult to do that. But fortunately for me, I'm inspired pretty much every month by the daily meditations from Father Richard Rohr, so I'll just make a donation. But I don't do it every month. I don't do it automatically. I do it because I want to.
Yeah.
And when we get that amount of money in every month, I send a tithe to Richard or to whomsoever. Then I put a little bit of money in our celebration fund so we can have treats, and then I pay the bills.
Ooh, I like the sound of a celebration fund.
Oh, absolutely. It's so important to have a celebration fund, which is because you're saying, God, us, everybody else. You're following the whole tithing system. And when I was really, you know, that time in London when I was peeling potatoes at basic wage, at minimum wage, and I was tithing sixpence, six old p, because that's all I had.
Mm.
But I would put them into a little box or a little bag and save them until I had a pound or something like that. And then the pound I would give wherever I could. Mm. And the other pound I'd buy some flowers or some chocolate or something for me.
Yay.
And oddly enough, once you're in this, it really works. I got a job as a secretary to an old friend of mine who's working in an internet startup company. And, you know, I'm a rubbish secretary. I didn't even know how to deal with all the inquiries. I used to sign my emails to people perplexed of Piccadilly. Because I just didn't know what I was doing. He'd given me a job because he loved me and he knew I was in such trouble.
Yeah.
And every lunchtime, because I was in I'm not a London person, but I was taking a 45-minute tube trip on the Northern Line. And it was great because I had to read a book because we get stuck in the tunnels. So I'd sit there and read a book and learn things.
Mm.
And at lunchtime, I went to Fortnum's. Okay. I walked around Fortnum's every day and I said, I deserve the right to be here. It wasn't really anything I wanted apart from some of the nice food.
Yeah.
But I turned up at Fortnum's every single day. And that year for my birthday, an old friend who didn't know me, didn't know what I was doing, but knew that I was financially in trouble, sent me a Fortnum's hamper.
Whoa. Awesome. Oh, my goodness.
I know. It wasn't one from... it was a hamper with stuff in it from Fortnum's, which he had put together for me with his girlfriend. And it was just such a sign that the universe was hearing me.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
You know, and that's what you have to do. And when I was working in London, after the whole this venture capital thing and all that, I started doing some prosperity teaching. And I lived 45 minutes out of the centre. My office was the Savoy. I could hire the Savoy for £20 because I would meet my client in the coffee room at the Savoy and I would pay for coffee and biscuits for us. And we'd sit there for 2 hours and talk prosperity. Now, don't you think that was a better thing to do for them than get them to drag them out to the little place that I was living up in Barnet?
Yeah. That's hilarious.
It is.
And just, you know, that is pure magic, you know.
Yeah. But think about it, 20 quid, you couldn't hire an office in London for 20 quid for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And you got exquisite service, and also I got known at the Savoy, which was also nice. So when Lion's daughter was 21, we still didn't have any cash, but I thought we could probably afford one £25 tea, which is what it was then. It's a lot more now. This is a long time ago. So we sort of saved up, and we actually bought two teas. We spent £50. We didn't buy her a present. We hadn't got anything else, and we all dressed up. And we went to the Savoy, and I had asked them to include a cake, which said, Happy 21st, Karen. And they forgot.
Ooh.
But they knew me. Yeah. So I just said to the maitre d', I said, and the cake, Mr. Rogers? And he said, yes, madam, and went away. And then he came back, and you could see him hesitate for a minute, and then he went back in the kitchen, and he came out with a beautiful chocolate cake and a bottle of champagne. And he said... And they put happy birthday very quickly on the cake.
Yeah.
And of course, Karen didn't know.
No, of course.
She just knew it was a birthday cake. And he just put down the cake and he said, Paul Roger, madame, is that sufficient? And I said, thank you, yes. Yeah. But that's prosperity consciousness. It wasn't, you didn't do the cake. It was just because it was the Savoy.
Yeah.
They mended it.
Yeah.
With probably what was a £50 bottle of, I don't know, but we had a champagne tea. And that's what I want to try and teach people. And you can teach anybody that. And even when I was younger, I knew that because this is the work I've come in to do, I'm sure. Sitting with Lenny Henry at the Dudley Herald when he was saying, oh, I don't know, it's all hopeless. And I was saying, of course you can do this. You're bright. Look at you. You have an ambition that most of us wouldn't even think about. Go for it. We're right behind you. And he won't remember you. Why would he remember me? Yeah. Absolutely, he won't remember me. But it was one piece in his jigsaw.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, and if you can help somebody with it, and it's coming back to Anne Lamott, which is lighthouses do not run around islands looking for ships to save.
I love that saying. Yeah.
So if I can work with my balance with the fact that I will not be getting this inheritance from my mother, I did not get the inheritance from my father, I've had to work, I will not be retiring, I did not get my pension at 60, I will continue to work probably till I die, and it's okay, you know?
And those are the exact same stories, uncannily close in the case of our dads.
Yeah.
In my life, yeah. And likewise, it's okay. I just want to say the story of the cafe, just because it was so...
God, we're on 40 minutes again. No, yes, go ahead!
Yes!
Oh, my goodness. Yes, tell the story of the cafe.
Okay, so I was working in this heavenly cafe, you know, not far from here. It was a truly lovely place. It absolutely gave me a job when I desperately needed one. It meant that I could have working family tax credits because our family was working.
Yeah.
And it gave me that feeling of total and utter safety that... Even though I fully realise, you know, spirits, gods, that I'm supposed to be doing this work on your behalf, this is giving me the security of there's whatever it was. I mean, a small amount. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Coming in at the end of every single month and that I can trust that we will not starve.
Mm.
And I got the message from the spirits that I really should be leaving that job and trusting that we would not starve without it.
Ooh,
and I ignored it.
Yeah.
And I just carried on. What I did do was I reduced my shifts from 5 to 4 and 4 to 3 and 3 to eventually 2. Over the course of, I think it took me 2 years of them going, you really should leave that job.
Yeah.
You really, really, really should leave that job. Anyway, then my brother from another mother and I had one morning a week working in that cafe, and I think I had another afternoon. Oh, I did. I had another afternoon, and again, I was working with such a lovely friend.
Mm.
And so, kind of work aside, I was a little bit resistant to leaving because it was lovely work, really sociable with people who I loved. But anyway, it transpired that it wasn't really working for the cafe to have so many people working one or two shifts here and there because there wasn't enough continuity. Yeah. And so they said to him, you've either got to take another shift or you've got to leave.
Mm.
And by that time he had another job. And so, but he didn't want to leave. And I heard about this and I said, all grandiose, well, if you sack him, you're going to have to, you'll consider yourselves to have sacked me also.
Mm.
Imagining that I was managing to save his job for him.
Oh, God.
No, instead they just asked me to leave too. And so both of us lost our jobs. And literally the next day I had a wave of work which has never really stopped.
Mm.
There has been enough ever since.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of me. On the one hand, I regret absolutely none of that because I wouldn't have had...
Your brother from another wife.
Yeah.
Well, woman, mother, sorry.
Yeah. But, you know, I wouldn't have been able to hang out with him. I wouldn't have been able to hang out with my other friend. We had the most glorious times together. So I don't at all regret it.
Yeah.
But what a lesson in we're telling you that you can trust us.
Yeah.
We're telling you for heaven's sake. And in the end, I didn't jump, so they pushed me.
Yeah. There's a lovely line I got from the Notes from the Universe from Mike Dooley on tut.com. It's a daily inspirational email that you get. And one of them was something like, would a parent ever leave a child in a terrible situation? No. But you're reading a book. You've got to go to the end. What it's actually sort of saying is, where you are right now is not the end of the story. The end of the story
is the end of the story. Yeah.
Don't hold on to this being the end of the story. If it's not a happy ending, it's not the end.
Yeah. It ain't over till the fat lady sings.